anti-US sentiments running high across Iranian cities as people rally to mark the day when students took over the US embassy 42 years ago. A top Iranian general says the foiled US attempt to steal Iran's oil proves the armed forces' readiness to stand against any threatening power. Plus, a top US general gives assurances of the Pentagon power to defend Taiwan from an attack by China if asked to do so. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story today is a very important day in Iran's history. It's named the National Day Against Global Arrogance, and Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding rallies to condemn US policies. Hours ago, crowds of people gathered on the streets in different cities in a show of their anger at the US atrocities towards their country. Over the past four decades, and now in the capital Tehran, the protesters gathered outside the building that used to be the US Embassy before the Islamic Revolution. 42 years ago on this day, a group of university students took over the embassy building amid anti-US anger. Now, traditionally, on this day, chants against the US can be heard from protesters who support resistance against Washington's hegemony. Since the 1979 takeover of the compound, Iranians have been commemorating that event every year by holding rallies. Our correspondent Saman Kajuri has been on the ground covering this year's rallies for us. He joined us earlier to explain what these annual protests signify and why they're important.
Today, people, this is of course a routine for every year that people get together and indeed mark the day in order to every year to show that they are still angry at the U.S. hegemonic policies, and they want to the U.S. to stop its hegemonic policies and also domineering policies in the past 42 years, not just against the Islamic Republic of Iran, but in general throughout the world. Because, as you might know, in the past 100 years, history shows that the United States has been active in different countries and has tried to topple the establishments of different countries, almost 60 countries worldwide. And according to experts, if 42 years ago, back in 1979, the students and Iranian students had not taken over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, well, the nascent Islamic Republic of Iran they would have been derailed. So actually the move by the Iranian students back in 1979 somehow guaranteed the stability and the security and the survival of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution of Iran in those days.
A top Iranian general says the recent incident in the Sea of Oman proves that Iran is serious in safeguarding its national interests and that its armed forces are fully prepared to stand against any external threat.
What happened on the 25th of October, the news of which was released yesterday, provides solid proof that the Iranian nation's youth will stand against any power that seeks to threaten their interests strongly, bravely, and faithfully.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says about 10 days ago, its naval forces foiled a U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the country's southern waters. The IRGC's chief commander now says Iran has never been seeking war but will definitely defend itself. Major General Hossein Salami says Iran is a powerful country that serves as an anchor of security in the region. He recalled the U.S. history of making wars globally and called on regional states not to expect foreign powers to bring peace to West Asia.
We are funding the operation.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps released a video on Wednesday which showed how its naval force foiled a recent U.S. attempt to steal a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC said the Americans seized a tanker and transferred its cargo to another vessel to divert it to an unknown destination. The IRGC forces, however, managed to land on the deck of the second tanker and diverted it into Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces unsuccessfully attempted to block the tanker's path using helicopters and warships. They also made another failed attempt to seize the tanker from entering the Iranian waters. The ship later docked in Bandar Abbas port on October the 25th.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions, but the purpose of such moves is very much clear, as Iran has been practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions.
The U.S. has been trying to prevent Iran from selling its oil since former President Donald Trump pledged to bring the country's crude exports to zero. This toes the lines of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Trump launched in 2018 following his unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last year, the Trump administration also threatened to deploy the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean Sea to stop Iran from delivering fuel shipments to Venezuela, but it failed to do so. Recently, when Iran began exporting fuel to Lebanon, the U.S. again vowed to impede the effort, but to no avail. Iran has time and again warned against U.S. adventurism in the West Asian region. Iranian officials say Tehran does not seek to get involved in a conflict with Washington, but will give a firm and crushing response to any military action. The recent confrontation in the Sea of Oman has highlighted Iran's military might and conveyed a message to the White House that the Iranian armed forces will not hesitate to defend the country and its interests.
Now, President Ibrahim Raisi says Iran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions imposed on the country. Raisi says Iran will not abandon the negotiating table, but will refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes the U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust and Washington needs to remove them. Iran has confirmed that talks with the P4+1, the remaining parties to the nuclear accord, are set to begin on November the 29th. The negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran after former President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in 2018. Political commentator Heinz Gartner says both the U.S. and the EU should offer Iran guarantees for a long-term commitment to the nuclear deal.
Of course, the Iranians want that all sanctions would be removed. I think that's a stumbling block because the U.S. will keep some of the sanctions. They would want to keep some leverage. And I understand also that for Iran, it's not only an economic issue, it's an issue of pride as well. So I do think it is possible. Of course, the other stumbling block is that the Iranians, what is very understandable, because the U.S. withdrew unilaterally from the deal, the Iranians want a guarantee for the next president in the U.S. That he will not or she will not leave the deal. That's hard to do for an American president to promise this because he doesn't have the support. But there are other possibilities. For example, in the rest of the Biden administration, the Iran can conclude long-term contracts with companies for 10 years or something, which go beyond the next administrations. And I have to say, the Europeans should give the guarantee to the Iranians if the United States would withdraw, that the Europeans would stay in the deal. So I haven't heard this from the Europeans, but that would be a good move if the Europeans could do so.
China is reacting to a visit by a European delegation to Taiwan. Beijing says Europe needs to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to the self-ruled island. A group of European Parliament officials are now visiting Taiwan for the first time. In a meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen, the head of the delegation has assured her that, quote, Taipei is not alone and that Europe is standing with it. China often advises Western governments, particularly Washington, against growing relations with Taipei In fresh comments, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, has said there's no question that the U.S. military is capable of defending Taiwan against a future attack by China. The top general says he does not expect China to wage a war to take control of Taiwan anytime soon, and that Washington wants to see a peaceful settlement of the dispute. China sees Taiwan as its own territory, but Taiwan wants independence and says it's ready to defend itself if there's an armed conflict. Time now for our news review program, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The Pentagon says a U.S. drone strike that killed 10 civilians in Kabul back in August did not violate any law. The U.S. Defense Department, that is, says its investigation has found that the attack was caused by a series of errors, including the interpretation of intelligence. Lieutenant General Sami Said, who headed the probe, has called the attack a regrettable mistake. The strike came days after Daesh bombing killed 13 American troops and scores of Afghan civilians outside Kabul airport's gates. The Pentagon had initially said the strike targeted a Daesh bomber who posed an imminent threat to U.S.-led troops. Joining us is Greg Simons, an author and researcher out of Uppsala in Sweden, and Tim Kirby, radio host and political commentator from Moscow. Gentlemen, welcome. If I can begin with you, Greg, the Pentagon here is saying that the airstrike killed 10 civilians but did not violate any law. We don't tend to see the United States being accountable to any law in any case, but here we see 7 children have been killed. What's your reading into this?
It's just the usual continuation of the flagrant violation of international law and rules of war. I mean, this is not an exception. It's happened so many times. I mean, this has been continuing on in Pakistan and Afghanistan and other places for decades. And the point is that, of course, I mean, an internal military investigation of their own military will, of course, find it's not guilty. But they have also been unwilling constantly to subject themselves to the International Criminal Court or any other international arenas where they could be judged. So, yes, I mean, it's just a continuation of the same thing. And even if they say it's not a violation of rules of war, it is, because what has happened and the way in which it's happened.
Right. Tim, so a misinterpretation of intelligence is what the Pentagon is also saying. Does that put a big question mark on U.S. intelligence, and perhaps not for the first time?
Well, certainly not for the first time, Mom. If we look back, especially to the Obama period, it became very evident that the drone strikes are not as promised. There's this certain media perception that you can somehow use a drone strike as in, you know, a major explosion to target, to be used as some sort of form of targeted assassination. Well, most of us, most of the time, are not walking completely by ourselves in a very large open field. So anytime you use a drone strike, you are going to get the collateral damage, as they call it. So again, this idea that they would launch a drone strike into an urban environment and somehow not kill random people, even if the information was perfectly correct and they got the target they wanted, it's still a very questionable tactic, and it's something we need to think about for the future. We need to stop lying to ourselves about the nature of this drone warfare.
Right. I mean, the Pentagon did admit that there was a child seen in the in a video 2 minutes before the drone strike. Greg, the investigation does not recommend any disciplinary action. What do you make of that?
Just a continuation of whitewashing war crimes, essentially. I mean, how many have been held to account? American military personnel in Afghanistan for butchering civilians, likewise in Iraq. I mean, it's just a continuation. This is the same thing. And no one is saying anything. They just continue the same so-called mistaken practices. But if you continue a mistake, then due diligence has not been done to correct any errors. So this is something more than just a mistake or an error.
And then, Kim, in your opinion, does this airstrike, in what was the final airstrike, reflect perhaps the wider U.S. invasion and 20-year occupation of Afghanistan?
It's sloppy. It was very sloppy. The entire war in Afghanistan was sloppy and irrational. From the start, analysts across America from both sides, be they liberal or conservative, were absolutely sure that Afghanistan was not going to work out. There are, of course, some clownish people who are in favor of any war that's ever been, but the idea of sort of transforming Afghanistan into France with bayonets and drone strikes just simply was never going to happen, but they did it anyways. And so again, this is sort of like the same logic of accomplishing some sort of urban drone strikes without killing civilians would never happen, but they do it anyways, and they did it anyways.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their thoughts and their time. Greg Simons, the author and researcher, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden, and also Tim Kirby, radio host and political commentator from the Russian capital, Moscow. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came and conquered and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Those two, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair.
So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine, the United States paying for all this.
First of all, very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power. And as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles, if you can imagine?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." But for Palestinians, it happens every day. Not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our situation, of what we're doing, and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this." And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000. So that the actually the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground. It is talking to people, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu Waglut, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yeah, so that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, the scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. The scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements, built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that, the kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director. Probably wasn't quite as veteran as when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this will this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, the Israel lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language. how you describe things. It's as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights through the eyesight of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah, through his words, through his sermons, through his lectures and his maxims. When he looks at adl, justice, which he applied as no one did in the history of mankind, he says, فَالْعَدْلُ أَشْرَفُهُمَا وَأَفْضَلُهُمَا. When he compares justice to generosity and to other forms that might look like justice, or someone might look like doing just, he says, no. The fact is, justice itself is the best thing out there. If it's applied to society, to people, life would change. Life will take a different form. And he put his utmost efforts in trying to establish justice in the society that he lived in the place that he was, that was under his command, that he was governing. And one might wonder why Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi put so much emphasis on justice itself and tried to apply it unlike others. You see here, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, first and foremost, when he tries to apply justice, he's deriving that from the Islamic teachings, from the Quran, from the tradition of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, not to mention the jurisprudential laws that has to be applied. Where you see those before him, they put that behind their back. Islam, Quran, tradition of the Prophet, jurisprudence did not mean anything to them. And even to the case of Fadak, when his land, the land of Fatima al-Zahra that belonged to her and to Amir al-Mu'min, was taken from them. So that is, they began their rulership by oppressing and observing the rights of other people and taking it away from them. Where in fact he done the opposite. So he says the best thing out there is that you need to give back to people. And he takes it so seriously until he says, Wallah, لَأَنْ أَبِيتَ عَلَى حَسَكَ السَّعْدَانِ. By God, that if I sleep on thorns, right? If I, you know, if my bed was made out of thorns, I'm happy to sleep on it. وَأُجَرُّ فِي الْأَغْلَالِ مُصَفَّدًا. That if they drag me with chains, أَحَبُّ إِلَيْ is more beloved to me من أن ألقى الله ورسوله يوم القيامة ظالما لبعض العباد. That I will have to face Allah and the Messenger being oppressor to some of his servants, not all of them. See the how precise he is in his words. First he says, I would sleep on thorns. I would rather sleep on thorns and get dragged with chains. Then take the right or oppress some, not all, لِبَعْضِ الْعِبَادِ, where those who were before him or those who came after him, they oppressed all the ibad, all the servants of Allah was oppressed before them. Let us take a break and then inshallah we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and how he viewed justice. And so we said that he gave that analogy that he would rather sleep on thorns, be dragged with chains, than oppress some of the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then he goes a step further in describing how far he is willing to go in trying to establish justice on earth. That concept that we lack so much today in the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world. I would truly need someone that sees things like Ali alayhi salam did. And he says, Wallah, لو أعطيت الأقاليم السبع. By Allah, if they gave me the 7 continents to do what? بما تحت أفلاكها. Whatever they contain from treasures. على أن أعصي الله في نملة. That I could commit a sin towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in an ant. Uslubuha jalb sha'iratin. That I take that wheat cover that the ants carries to eat. He says, I would not do it. To that extent, he would go to that limit, to something that we could hardly see. When it comes to ants and when they carry small things for them to eat, we can't even see them unless we sit down and, you know, put a more concentration in order to see it. Amir al-Mu'minin says, to that extent, that I will not go to an ant and deprive her of her sustenance. How would he come and deprive people of their sustenance, which are, at least in size, much bigger than ants? So you see how it played such a massive role, the concept of justice, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, that he applied it in his time, that to the extent he would go looking around for people that might need help, for people who are poor, for people that he can give them their rights. He would go knock on doors, and those before him, they would come to people and take from them, not give them. So the concept of justice, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, begins as an Islamic concept, as a Quranic concept, as a traditional concept of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, that he sees himself obliged to enforce and to apply. It's not a commodity. It's not something, an extra, that if he applies, all good and well. So all the rulers of the world, Muslims or non-Muslims, when they apply justice, they shouldn't be doing it out of, oh, I'm a good person, or I'm doing it out of favor, or I'm looking after my people. No, this is your Islamic duty. And it is mine and yours as well, because sometimes we put in a position where we have to be just to our families, for example, to our kids, to our students, I don't know, to our workers, and you move up. The concept of justice needs to be applied based on the fact that it is what Allah wants, not what I want, not because I'm doing people a favor. So you see that the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the society of Amir al-Mu'mineen that he governed, it was based on nothing but justice, to the extent that nor his friends or his enemies were able to deny Amir al-Mu'mineen that right. Even his enemies, no matter how much they hated him, they always come back and say, when it comes to the rule of Ali, to the government of Ali, that no one could apply justice and no one has gave justice its right and performed it correctly as much as he did. That's even the words of his enemies, yet alone his friends. So if we need to apply justice in society and in this world, it has to be stemmed from the fact that it is an Islamic, Quranic, traditional of the Prophet concept, not a favor that we apply or give to people. We will leave it here, and inshallah we will continue in episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.